Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce, and Greg Erickson of the Alaska Budget Report, who is joining us by Skype. Paul, the election is over just about.
Yay!
What did we learn from this election?
Well, I think we learned that a couple of things. One, redistricting really does count. It really does matter. And I think that voters, they returned the Senate to Republican control. They left the House in Republican control. We now have a Republican in the governor's office. So as we did when Murkowski was governor, it's all lined up.
The stars are in alignment.
The stars are in alignment. I think that's what we used to say. And what will happen is anybody's guess. Other than that, there was apparently some distaste for the coalition politics that went on in the Senate. That coalition is no more, at least on paper. Who knows what will come out of the rubble, and we move forward.
Okay. It appears that incumbent Senator Hollis French will defeat challenger Bob Bell. If he wins, how did he do it?
Well, if he wins, it'll be by not very many votes. I think he's leading now by 50, give or take.
Right, yeah, right.
He was outspent. French outspent Bell at least 2-1, and by some estimates, 3-1. Bell had a primary, and Hollis French did not. Bell spent his $75,000 in the primary, got another $75,000 together for the general election, and French didn't have to deal with any of that. Probably not even current as of today, $225,000 his election coffers. And that doesn't include the union PACs and union help that went into this. And when they redistrict that district, the north part of that district remained heavily Democratic. And I guess if you were an independent...
That's the Lindsey Holmes House District.
It was heavily, heavily Democratic. And it was pounded every day with mailers and ads attacking Bell and bolstering French. So all in all, I mean, it was, if you don't have to spend money in a primary and the redistricting didn't hurt you that badly, and Bell got in late as well, so... I don't know. I think it was destined from the first minute. I'm surprised, I guess, that it's this close at this point.
Okay. Greg Erickson, the Alaska legislature has organized. Both houses have organized. What can you tell us about the makeup of the Senate?
Well, I think that I would certainly endorse what my friend Mr. Jenkins said about reapportionment being important, but I would focus more on what happened in Fairbanks than perhaps in Anchorage. Although I will say on the French issue, a Democrat who was a leader in the coalition that now is no more, it's sort of surprising that the oil industry, which strongly opposed his policies, didn't put more money into Mr. Bell's campaign. But up in Fairbanks is where the real votes changed, and the coalition lost two key Democratic senators, Joe Thomas and Joe Pascan, the two Joes. That was critical for this new coalition that formed, or some would call it a Republican majority. But I agree entirely with Paul. It's really up in the air as to what will actually come out of this. I don't think oil tax reform, quote unquote, is going to be a slam dunk. It seems to me that we're going to see a very bad development, which we've seen before, and that is that when they have these big coalitions, everything gets done in caucus, and you don't really see what's going on.
Were you surprised that Democrats joined the Republicans in the Senate majority?
No, not surprised at all. I'm not surprised with the names of the Republicans who joined. It's been announced so far that Dennis Egan from Southeast, a conservative Democrat, fair to say, and who's the other Democrat that joined?
Donnie Olson
from Barrow. Not surprising that they joined, and I wouldn't be surprised if one or two others don't also join. But the larger that caucus gets, the more likely it is that everything will be done inside it.
And does Egan Paney Price, I mean, he was a backbone Democrat during the campaign, with public opinion, I mean.
Well, I don't think so. Not down in Juneau, in his constituency. Juneau is well aware of the need to have representatives in the seats of power. Always the capital move is looming over, and always the capital budget is the big issue for not just Southeast senators, but everybody. So I don't see any backlash in his constituency. And Beth Kertula, who is the minority leader in the House, also a Democrat, was clearly supportive of him in his decision to do that.
And what of the Republican leaders in the coalition, Gary Stevens and Bert Stedman? What about them?
Well, they both accepted relatively backbench positions. Bert Stedman is going to head the Health and Social Services Committee, and my gosh, I have to say, he put as fine a face on that downgrade as anyone has done in a long time. Said he was excited to be trying and getting into something else, and you know, he was pretty honest about it. He said, you know, it wasn't what I wanted, but hey, you got to do what you could, you know, make lemonade out of the lemons. So he is truly impressed me over the years with the strength of his intellect and his attention to the job, and I'm sure he'll do a good job there. Tim, and I'm sure that if everything goes on in the caucus, he'll be a voice to deal with by anybody who wants to do something stupid.
And to put a point on it, Tim, what are the fate of the Democratic minority, which is all from Anchorage, the four senators in the minority?
Well, I think we still have Lyman Hoffman from Bethel.
That's right, the fifth.
Outrider, too. But still, these are one thing to say about these people is they are all experienced legislators, and they're very knowledgeable, and I would, in a way, even though the numbers, I think their influence may outweigh their numbers, because they'll be in a position to be a strong opposition, I think, and particularly if they have media coverage. And some of them,
and they'll know how to play that, that's
yeah,
for sure.
And some of them are quite articulate and can voice, particularly on things like oil tax reform. I can just hear Hollis French being quite pointed in his criticisms of what the majority is trying to do. So I think there's still going to be a very force to be reckoned with.
Let's go back to Greg. Greg in the House, Mike Chenault was elected Speaker for a third time. This is unusual.
Yes, it is. And I talked to Mike yesterday and the new Speaker, Speaker Designate. I asked him, what do you attribute your remarkable success in three consecutive terms? And he said it was his good looks. But if you know Mike, I would doubt that. I think the real reason is that Mike has a reputation both on both sides of the aisle as being very fair, and that he has a political position that's probably to the right, at least on economic issues, to the rest of his caucus. But people who disagree with him on substantive issues have almost universally say he's a fair presiding officer.
And I would guess he's good at solving people's problems when they come to him with internal concerns. Wouldn't you guess that that's a strength you have to have?
Absolutely. I talked to Hugh Malone when he was Speaker, Ben Grusendorf when he was Speaker, and they all agree that one of the most important jobs that a Speaker has is holding hands and doing psychotherapy for the people who feel aggrieved, you know?
That's terrible, Representative from Fairbanks. I will do the best I possibly can to help you.
How could this happen?
Paul, oil appears to be the dominant issue in the upcoming legislature. Appears that it will dominate the legislature. But given the makeup of this legislature and its conservative slant, would you be surprised if social issues rise to the top?
I don't know if they'll rise to the top. I think that they'll be brought up. I think they'll play some role in debates and backroom fighting over the oil tax cuts. But I think politicians nowadays are leery even Republicans.
You mean they might have learned something here?
I think it's one of those lessons they learn the hard way. There's going to be the impetus to do it. There's going to be the desire to do it. But I think they'll get hammered if they do, and I think they understand that. So I have no idea whether they'll try to really push abortion. Abortion's a loser for them. I don't know why they would do that, but I suppose there are other issues that that they could bring up, partial birth.
Well, if Greg's right, and a lot of the work in the Senate is done in caucus,
right.
they can pretty much decide what the calendar is going to be right
well,
there.
Well, I think so. And they air it out in there, they get it settled in there, and we move on.
Okay, Tim, Mike Wallery, the Fairbanks lawyer for the Ester men who filed a lawsuit against reapportionment, came out and said that he was concerned about racial gerrymandering in the outcome of the election, or having a role in the outcome of the election, especially in House District 38. What do you make of that, and why would he make that claim now?
Well, Mike, I think the results of the election, and particularly the organization, has clearly left the Bush way out there in the cold. The Bush for years has been very influential in the legislature. Now they are not. They have none of the seats of leverage or seats of power or influence that they previously had. I think this is probably, of course, we know that the case is still in court, still in the Supreme Court. The whole redistricting issue is still live legally. And I think this is probably just a way of getting it quickly back in the legal arena in the public consciousness again.
And there's, it's quite interesting that it's possible that the United States Supreme Court will take up some of these issues about racial districting.
That's right. And so this is a way of sort of just, you know, just stoking up the attention to the issue again, I think.
Okay, Paul, we have the reapportionment plan. It's called an interim plan. How long is it going to take to get us a final plan?
I think predicting what a court or a jury will do is really a waste of time. There's no way of telling. The suit was filed in Superior Court, which said, hey, you didn't do this right. You considered federal law over your Constitution. Go back and fix it. They tried to fix it. Didn't work. Supreme Court. And it's been sitting there for some time now. Whether it will come out anytime soon, there's no rush now. The election's over. It was an interim primary. It was an interim redistricting for the election. They're not going to be rushed into doing it. The idea, of course, is to keep racial balance in all these districts and try to preserve minority votes. And in the process of him doing this, we now have the NAACP wondering if it shouldn't pursue a similar lawsuit in the case of Betty Davis, who lost to Anna Faircloth.
That would seem to be a little late, wouldn't it?
I'm not sure. You never know with courts. I mean, that's the problem. In a redistricting case there that clearly rather favored Faircloth. So.
Greg Erickson, here's a big question. Governor Sean Parnell got what he wanted out of this election. He got a Republican Senate, or a Republican Senate different from the coalition that he had before. What do you expect from Governor Parnell during the coming session of the legislature?
Well, I think it's clear that the governor plans to introduce some sort of new oil tax reform legislation. And it will be interesting to see, what's in that. They've hired a consultant, or the Department of Revenue has hired a consultant, to try to rework the losing proposal that they failed to get adopted last year, last 2 years. So I guess I'd challenge that he got exactly what he wanted. He certainly wanted to get rid of those articulate and knowledgeable Democrats, Bilikowski and French, and both of them got reelected. So that was definitely a failure. I certainly want to reemphasize what Tim said, that the members of that Democratic minority in the Senate are very articulate. And I think we might see an effort on the part of the Republican Senate to not place the Democrats' choice on their finance committee, because that would give whoever it is, like Hoffman or Bilikowski or French, a platform on which to speak to the TV cameras just about every day.
Can they do that under the rules?
The rules say you're supposed to acknowledge the or accede to the minority caucus, but in the past, the majority has exercised the rule of 11 in the Senate, which says it doesn't matter what the rules are. If you got 11 votes to do it differently, you can. And that happened when the Democrats tried to put Al Adams on the Senate Finance Committee some years ago, and also when they tried to put Kim Elton. The Republicans didn't want those articulate voices on that committee, and they blocked those appointments successfully.
Quickly, will Governor Parnell be able to keep the budget from growing as he and many Republicans pledge?
No. I'd like to give you a long, involved answer, but 35 years of experience down here tells me that's not going to happen, and they'll probably do what usually happens. They'll try to use smoke and mirrors and accounting tricks to make it look like they've cut the budget, but no, they won't.
Okay, one final question for you, Greg, on Parnell. What of his relationship with the federal government? He's now turned down the Obama requirements for, or suggestion for health insurance exchanges, and said the federal government can run them. What do you make of that?
Well, it's a conflict between two mantras that have been so prevalent in Alaska politics for years and years. The one is that we can do it better ourselves. We understand the unique circumstances of Alaska, and so let us handle these issues ourselves. And the other one is a Republican mantra that Parnell represents very, very articulately, pretty articulately anyhow, that we want to keep the feds out of our business, and we don't want to have a lot of requirements posed on us by the federal government that cost us money in our budget. So in this case of the health exchanges, they have to be in place by January 1, 2014. The states have until December now to make a final decision, but as you say, Governor Parnell has already rejected the idea of the state running its own exchange or entering a joint exchange with other states. So the feds are now tasked with setting up the exchange for us. The important thing about these is that they implement one of the major things of the Affordable Health Care Act, Obamacare, in that they're the place where people go to get the mandatory insurance if they don't have it from some other source. And secondly, when you get all those additional people into the insurance pool, it allowed the feds to say you can't disallow anybody for pre-existing conditions, and you have to accept people who are sick as well as people who propel.
Okay, let's get Tim Bradner in here. Tim, your perspective on Parnell as he approaches this session.
Well, my initial thought is the governor is so partisan in his view of this thing that it's just that permeates every decision that he makes on it. But a point,
partisan in dealing with the Obama administration.
Yeah. I mean, that colors everything, his views on the whole thing. But secondly to that, it just seems very ironic to me that here we have the governor rejecting an exchange that we could manage and Alaskanize by setting up for Alaskan conditions. And instead, we're going to have to deal with a federal exchange created by bureaucrats foisted on us. And that's going to be the result of his decision. Just one more quick thing on this. A really critical decision the governor has yet to make is whether he will allow the state to expand Medicare coverage to the in the way that the Affordable Health Care Act requires. Under the Supreme Court decision, not all states, that's voluntary to states. And the governor has made noises about that we're not going to expand Medicare. And that would mean that there'd be still a lot of uninsured Alaskans.
Tim, let's stick with you. The reports are gaining currency that we really may be running short of natural gas here in Cook Inlet. Tell us more.
Mike, it's a fact. The utilities are saying that the gas fields we know are running down more rapidly than we think. And there is now a gap in our supplies that's going to show up in 2014, maybe 2015. There are new wells being drilled out in Cook Inlet. They will not, in prospects may look good, but they will not find gas or be able to deliver gas in time. So the only practical alternative is importing LNG or compressed natural gas. As embarrassing as that is, the utilities are very practical, and they say, look, we got to have the heat on, we got to have the power on, we're going to have to do it. And they're doing it. They're going to do it.
The politicians, one of the examples we have here is what happened in New York State and New Jersey during this hurricane. I mean, it's different circumstance, but the anger that the public feels towards the power companies is very deep in these, when if your power goes off.
Or your heat goes off in the wintertime. But it's a serious problem, and I think the utilities and the regulator, the RCA, is going to have to approve this, are being very practical. But the politicians are very red-faced about this. They it's very embarrassing that this is happening on their watch. Of course, it could be a temporary situation if the gas explorers are lucky and they find
and
a lot of gas.
We have to assume that the companies that are going to get natural gas, that use natural gas, they want to err on the side of making sure they have plenty, right?
All the utilities have to, they are legally obligated to make sure that they serve their consumers. They don't have a choice. They've got to do something. And it just seems, it's very embarrassing, but it's a situation we're in and we have to deal with it.
Okay. Paul, big news on the front page of the Anchorage Daily News on Friday. British Petroleum has pled guilty to a variety of charges in the Gulf of Mexico. There are going to be all kinds of fines, civil penalties, money that's required for them to provide for various institutions and organizations in Louisiana along the coast. Does this have any impact on Alaska, given the role that BP plays here?
I think it has to. I mean, that's money that's coming out of the kitty. It's investment dollars. That's operational budget money. That's money they normally would use for something else. Thank God for high gasoline prices, I suppose they're saying, over the past few years. But, you know, if they were smart, they socked this money away 2 years ago, and it's been drawing interest ever since. But, yeah, it's got to have an effect here. That's a huge chunk of money to take out of a company's bottom line.
And already the Democrats are saying they're going to pay it with our money.
They're going to pay it with our money. Okay. Yeah, I like that.
Greg, what does the election of this legislature coupled with this governor mean for the future of a gas line in Alaska, a gas line to, well, at this point, anywhere?
Well, there are a number of gas line proposals, and I think that the one that is probably most affected by the election, if any of them are affected by it, is the Alaska standalone gas pipeline proposal, which was fielded last year by Speaker Mike Chenault and Representative Mike Hawker, along with AHFC Chief Dan Fauske, and supported sort of lukewarmly by the Parnell administration. That passed the House and got a $400 million kitty from the House, but the Senate said, no, not going to do that now because there's cheaper ways to get good gas to Fairbanks and want to run the gas line in the other direction and so forth. So that was stalled. I think the new coalition in the Senate is possibly going to be more receptive to that. Certainly that's what Mike Chenault, who I talked to yesterday, said he hopes. And so I think that's that probably helps that project, which has got a final EIS now pending before the Corps of Engineers, and it looks like some critical questions there have been answered in the way the pipeline promoters wanted, namely whether they were going to have to deal with exports in the EIS. But as my friend Tim has pointed out before the program, the big issue here is whether they can get the huge subsidy, the huge capital subsidies from the state treasury that they feel are necessary to build that line.
Tim, if we're talking about subsidies here, what realm of finance would that be? What are we talking about?
Well, there's a number of ways you could finance that pipeline. What the project needs right now is a few hundred million dollars to do the engineering, finish the engineering work so they can be far enough along that they can get hard bids from somebody who wants to ship gas through it. They're looking at $400 million just to do that. They have spent about, I'm going to get this wrong, maybe $40 million on engineering. They need to spend a lot more money to really nail down the cost estimates. The legislature has to appropriate that, and that's what got, as Greg mentioned, got hung up last year. Now, beyond that, who's going to pay to build it? Ordinarily, the people who ship gas pay to build it. We'll know, we have to have what's an open season to know if anybody wants to ship gas through this pipeline. The state does have the choice of just paying for it, which is one idea. You'd have awfully inexpensive gas going down because there wouldn't essentially be any
tariff.
And
how much would that cost, though, or do we know?
The estimates are $7.6 billion in that range for the pipeline. The state could also just issue revenue bonds, and the revenues from the project from the shippers, if there are shippers who sign contracts, would pay for the bonds. That's okay. Ordinarily the way pipelines are
done. In a final minute, Paul, the Anchorage Assembly and the mayor have apparently agreed on a budget for Anchorage for next year.
Well, there was an A budget and a B budget. I think we're now to the C or D budget, and I think everybody is relatively happy. All the cuts are back. The things that were cut out are back. The positions that weren't filled were cut. And I think they've got to where they wanted to be, and it's probably where they wanted to be from day one.
Does this surprise you that they were able to come up with what appears to be an agreement before Thanksgiving, when sometimes we've gone into summer?
It's gone forever, yeah. No, this I think when you've got Dan Sullivan and an assembly that is 6-5 at this point, so no, I'm not surprised they reached it this soon, not at all.
Okay, and now they can go on to their next project, the assembly can, which is reapportionment.
I can hardly wait.
Yes, we've had so much fun with reapportionment.
Well, yeah, and the statewide, and it's very important in the city. There's going to be a drive at some point to make the school district into districts as well. So all of this will play into each other.
Well, we can't go into that drive any further because we are out of time. Thank you very much for joining us right here on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.